danger is stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 81 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Catonsville, Maryland. I am Andrew Brokus, and with me is Nate Mavis.
From Somerville, Massachusetts. How are you today?
I'm doing well enough. How are things in Somerville?
Fantastic. The weather's nice and everything's good. I'm scouting out plane fare for my annual trip to Las Vegas, and I really couldn't be happier about that.
Except that the plane fare has been expensive.
Yeah, something like twice as expensive as it's been in other years. And I've done something between 50 and 80 searches for plane fare on the relevant dates. So I'm really very well schooled in the cost of these plane tickets. And they're just more expensive this year than they have been other years. And I don't know why. Very bad.
Well, I found a clever way to avoid at least half of the plane fare, which is that I'm going to be carpooling with three children under the age of 10
on <to go. laughs>
a cross-country road trip. Some people will remember I've mentioned before my cousin who lives in Western Maryland has some kids that I'm pretty close with, and in fact they're the ones I mentioned. I think it was on episode 79 I talked about. Maybe it was even the last episode, episode 80. I talked about teaching the oldest boy a little bit of poker, playing heads up one card poker with him. So this is the family we're talking about. My cousin's wife is originally from Idaho, and she hasn't been back there in about 5 years since they moved to Maryland, which is where my cousin is from. So she hasn't been back to like see any of her friends and family in 5 years. Just a combination of it's expensive, and they've had the kids, and she just hasn't been able to. So she has a friend who's getting married in Tahoe, and on I think July 3rd, so right around there. And she was just like, "I'm just going. You know, I wanted to see my friends, and it's never going to happen if I restrict myself to things like what's feasible. You know, what I can actually do without losing my mind." So she had just decided she was going to drive. My cousin wasn't able to get off of work. She was just going to drive across the country with the three kids just by herself. And I think kind of jokingly, she was like, "I mean, unless you're up for a road trip." And I was like, "Well, I do actually need to be in Las Vegas roughly that time." So I don't know. I'm doing it in no small part to help them out, because obviously it'll be a pretty big help to her to have a second adult along the way. I think it'll be an experience. I have a lot of experience working with kids. Usually, most of my experience is working with high school kids. I spent a lot of time with these particular kids, but not usually in a disciplinary role. Not for, you know, an extended period of time where I'm kind of responsible for making sure they're not like hurting each other.
Right.
So it'll be an adventure, but I'll have a few days. I'm getting out there a couple days in advance of the main event, so I'll have a few days to recover. I wouldn't have agreed to do it if it was like I'm going to get there the day before I start playing or something. I think it'll probably be tiring, but I'm going to have a few days. And I'm not really planning on playing other tournaments. So I have the option of not playing poker at all for those couple of days when I get out there, if I find that I really need to recover.
You're a good man. And I
I'm looking forward to it, to be honest. I don't want to make myself sound like a martyr. I'm looking forward to it.
No, and I actually think it'll be plenty fine. I mean, for myself, the prospect of drinking a cup of tea at 30,000 feet and studying the nuances of pot limit Omaha 8 or better, that sounds a little bit better to me.
Yeah, I'm not going to get a lot of reading done.
Speaking of pot limit Omaha 8 or better, I think I can actually play that event this year. I'll probably be out in time for the 3K. So
I'm really excited for you.
Yeah. That was my main game for something like a year and a half. And I still sweat the games online, the ones that I can't play because I'm in America. And I think I still know a lot of things about that game, so I'm really looking forward to that event.
The composition of that field should be interesting, because it seems like you're not going to get a ton of recreational people, given that there is a $1,500 PLO8 going also, and probably a lot of the best no-limit tournament players in the world are going to be playing that event because they're all bracelet hunting, or a lot of them are bracelet hunting, and so they're going to look to play more small field events. How much of an edge, if any, do you think that you, as someone who has significant PLO8 experience, but are maybe not as, I mean, obviously you're not like a tournament player on the order of a lot of the people we're talking about. How do you figure you're going to stack up against those folks?
So I think I'll be a real favorite for a few reasons. One is that although you're not going to get the most casual, you know, watching WPT once a week and not really knowing much else about the game fan playing that tournament, like if those people are going to take one shot, it's going to be in a 1K or a 1500. And even if it's not a low limit game, one nice thing about this year's schedule is that there are $1,500 events in a lot of forms of poker, right? So you're not going to get those people. You are going to get, I think, the sort of people who show up to, say, a 40-80 mixed game in Las Vegas. And I have a lot of experience in those games. And although you don't get all of the sort of John Q public people off the street, those people generally go and play no limit. And if they're playing a limit game, they'll play limit hold'em. But you do get like poker enthusiasts, people who really care about the game, who consider themselves good players, who are thoughtful about it, but who are ultimately not full-time poker players and who are in some sense not complete students of the game, who like to play the other games, who have money, you know, people like that. And I think that I've spent a lot of time studying exactly how to play against those people. As for tournament experts, I think you need to distinguish two kinds of players. There are people who understand sort of tournament fundamentals in the deepest way. There are people who are really good at no-limit tournaments. And as longtime listeners of the podcast know, a lot of these tournament principles manifest themselves very differently in a split pot game, and especially in Pot Limit Omaha 8 or better, depending how the equities go, because the equities are different. So, for example, you know, you can't shove 13 big blinds first in before the flop. That's a simple thing. But also, you know, these large re-raises before the flop, they don't carry the same kind of existential threat that a large re-raise does in no limit hold'em, just because you're going to split the pot a lot of the time. And well, I guess that's the biggest thing. So that's very important. And in general, like a smart no limit player is going to, you know, understand how hands interact with flops pretty well. A lot of these people have picked up Omaha at some point, so people who are Omaha high players will really know how some hands are interacting with flops. But the starting hand ranges are very different. There's a lot of room for experience to help you in PLO8. And especially given that there are some intangible things that will be on my side, namely, I'll be studying this game a lot more than other games, and I won't be burnt out after 50 events. Like, I'm going to come out, rest for a day and a half, and then play this event, right? So I'm going to be playing my best, and I'll have really studied my equities. Like, I'll really know what's going on, and I might even be able to play some like warm up PLO8 on WSOP.com in Las Vegas. I think even if you're from out of state, you can play that. I feel good about my chances. I've played a lot of PLO8 against hold'em players before. I've played a lot of non hold'em games against your sort of sophisticated recreational player before. And I think this is a case where the edge might be a little bit bigger than it appears.
Yeah, I mean, my experience playing the $1,500 PLO8 last year, which, you know, again, I do think will be a pretty different field, but I was initially kind of intimidated. Like, I mean, I don't have anywhere near your breadth of experience with PLO8. It's a game that I enjoy, that I've studied a bit and played a bit, and I was kind of playing this event just for fun. I felt like initially everyone at my starting table, like, they seemed to know more what they were doing than I expected. Like, a lot of people were talking very intelligently and seemed very competent at like splitting the pot, but they were also playing in ways that seemed very wrong to me. And I was like, do I just not know what I thought I knew about PLO8? Is everything I thought I knew wrong? And it turned out these people just weren't that good. Yeah. Even though they talked a better talk than I did, a lot of them did not ultimately play very well. And not that this was solely due to a huge skill edge on my part, but I did end up making the final two tables of that tournament. So I think that there are, in addition to, like, I think certain really, really good No Limit players who don't have a lot of PLO8 experience, like if Vanessa Selbst is in this tournament, you know, I wouldn't count on having a big edge against her.
No.
But there are a lot of, I think there are probably a lot of good No Limit, like six No Limit tournament players who have a history of success in No Limit tournaments, who are going to underestimate how difficult it will be for them to just pick up PLO8 without much experience and play it, and who probably are a little bit delusional about how much the things that they know about No Limit are going to transfer into PLO8. I think that's true.
I think that's right. And part of this is just that we talked quite a bit about your experience last year, and although the field will be different, even once you got down to the last tables, when I was sweating you online,
there were some big mistakes.
Yeah, and even more than the big mistakes, I didn't think that you were being put in tough spots a lot. Like when you're playing against tough players,
well, we were really shallow too. I mean, there weren't that many tough spots to end up in.
Yeah, but you can put pressure on people, right? Like there are ways. I mean, one thing the tournament players do know is how to pressure small stacks. And, right, of course, with the split pot effect, that's different. But, like, I people were letting you off the hook a little bit, I thought. And just in general, there wasn't the same level of making your life difficult that I thought there maybe would have been if you had been playing with people who were really super solid. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to that. And then probably also the 10-game mix before the main. So nice. I haven't played as many as three events in a very long time. This is going to be a great year, I think.
For me, I think it's going to be just the main event. I went out, I did the whole summer out there last year. I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I was going to. I think partly I had, it wasn't a very profitable summer, or, you know, by not very profitable, I mean unprofitable summer for me, which I'm sure contributed to it. But I'd never done it before. I just don't like playing that much live poker in a row. I took more time off than I thought I was going to. I got kind of lonely being out there for a while. I didn't find it to be a fantastic experience. So I'm just going to be doing the main event this year. That's not the only reason. It's also just kind of a busy time for me. But we've had a lot of people who have asked about if we're going to do a meetup again this year, which we did last year that went better, I think, than either of us expected that it was going to. And
absolutely,
I would imagine now we're going to get an even bigger turnout because our listenership certainly has gone up a lot since. I mean, this was a pretty new endeavor at the main event last year. We were only a few months old at that time.
Yeah, I thought it might be just the two of us and maybe like one or two other people showing up. But then we got some confirmations and it's like, oh, maybe there will be 10 people. And then like we're filling up the whole Starbucks. So it was popular last year. It might be a little more popular this year.
Now, I mean, to be honest, we've been a little remiss in our planning for this. But I do want to give people at least an idea of when it's likely to be so that they can plan accordingly, because we have had some people asking. Unfortunately, I don't think either of us is going to be out there too much before the main event. I know, Nate, what day are you planning on getting out there? Do you know?
If all goes according to plan, it will be June 27th. I'm going to land at I don't have a ticket yet, like the evening of June 27th. So after that,
yeah, it'll probably be July 2nd or 3rd for me.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about doing, and this is not 100%, but some people have asked, and I imagine it might affect their planning. So I want to give folks who are interested in coming. I mean, first off, we're flattered that you're sufficiently interested to come out and ask, and we apologize for not having more firm details to give you. Yeah. But the tentative plan is to do something very similar to what we did last year, which is to meet at 10 a.m. on Saturday, July 5th. So this is the morning of day 1A, to meet at the Starbucks in the Rio Convention Center. So this is the one that's kind of at the in that long hallway between the area where the WSOP is played and the rest of the Rio, I imagine. Yeah. Anyone who's been there knows where the Starbucks is. If you've never been there, it's very easy to find.
Yeah, it's the one right next to the restaurant with like the really mediocre food that's like just good enough to eat on a break if you're desperate.
That's not there. It can probably be described in the same way, but the Sao Paulo Cafe that you're thinking of is closed, and they've opened they've opened a different or possibly just rebranded something else in that same space. but I imagine it will still meet the description that you just gave.
There are worse things. I have a lot of memories at the former South Hollywood.
Okay, the biggest problem was just waiting in line for a long time to get a seat.
It's true, and it's not really food you want to wait in line for.
Exactly. Yeah. Like,
right. And look, even if you don't like Andrew or me, the best people listen to the show. You really want to come meet the other listeners. It's a really good time.
So tentatively, Saturday, July 5th, 10 a.m., Rio Convention Center, Starbucks. And we will do our best to, I think hopefully by next week's episode, we should be able to put something firmly in place. Mostly we're just holding out for the hope that we might be able to find a cooler venue than that, but it's not very likely. So in all likelihood, this is what it will be, and there's an outside chance it'll be something else, and we'll let you know as soon as we can.
That's right. And we're not the only ones who are thinking about Las Vegas. We're getting questions from people who are asking us for generic World Series of Poker advice. And sometimes we would just read an email here, but we've gotten several emails to the effect, hey, I'm going to the World Series this year. What should I do? So let's give them some general World Series of Poker advice.
I think if you're the sort of person who's asking that question, my guess is that you're a serious amateur player. A professional should be going in with the mindset of, you know, this is just another poker tournament, and I'm going to approach it more or less the same way I approach other poker tournaments. Like, if you're a professional coming in expecting that the WSOP is going to be something like way different than other tournaments that you've played, I think you're making a mistake. Certainly, like, your strategic approach to it shouldn't be wildly different. I think hopefully a lot of people have gotten beyond this mindset by now, but you hear things like, oh, well, you really have to gamble early in the 1Ks or early in the 1500s, or it's a minefield and you have to avoid the weakest players. I mean, this is not going to be wildly different than other, you know, online tournaments that you've played before, or, you know, the live tournaments you've played before, for that matter. And I don't think that your basic strategic approach needs to vary that much. Something that I really want to emphasize, this really applies to the professionals as well, but to the amateurs more than anything, is to focus on enjoying the experience. I think if you get too wrapped up in like trying to cash or fantasizing about winning a bracelet or something like that, I mean, the odds are just so heavily against you, like even to cash if you're only playing a couple of events. And that's not to say that you're a weak player. It's just the reality of it. No matter how good you are, the odds are against you cashing. So one of the biggest mistakes that you can make is coming in, putting a lot of pressure on yourself and saying like, okay, this is it, the World Series, this is my chance to make a name for myself. Like, it's not that. It's a chance for you to enjoy one of the world's biggest poker tournaments with a bunch of other people from all over the world who also enjoy playing poker. You'll play with some of the worst players you've ever played with and some of the best players you've ever played with. So it's an opportunity for you to play with some world-class players without having to put five figures down on the table if you're not playing the main event. So, you know, focus on enjoying the experience, focus on testing your mettle as a poker player and trying to play your best. Don't focus on trying to survive to the next day. Don't panic if you lose some of your chips in the early going or if you get into some tough situations. Look at it as a chance to enjoy yourself and as a learning opportunity.
That's right. And if you want more advice than this, this is a Poker News podcast. As it happens, there's a Learn Poker News branch of Poker News. It's largely the responsibility of a guy named Martin Harris, who was one of our early guests on the show and who is awesome. I contribute articles to this. There's a whole like subsection on World Series preparation. I actually like a lot of the stuff that's going up there. I wrote one of those articles. I should have a second one going up if Martin thinks it's good enough pretty soon. So,
it's pretty hard for me to imagine Martin turning away anything that you're writing for him.
Well, you never know. These are different. And I'm always happy to hear what Martin thinks. He's a wise editor. So, yeah, I've got some other advice. You know, one of the articles is more about strategic adjustments you might have to make and, you know, a general approach to playing in Las Vegas during that time if you're new to it. And a second one is like just sort of a grizzled veterans list of things that you ought to remember. And these are like very mundane things, like it's going to be hard to park and stuff like that. But things that might be useful to know. So Learn Poker News. There's stuff there. There are answers to your questions if you have questions about playing the World Series.
In case you haven't figured it out yet, there's not a guest this week. It's just going to be Nate and myself. We've basically reached the end of the babbling portion of the show. So we're going to be diving into some strategy in just a moment, or some more hand-specific strategy. We'll move a little further away from the generic stuff. First, want to make sure we let you know that our strategy segment is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. And although we will be talking about some specific tournament hands today, if you really want an in-depth look at tournament poker strategy, then you should check out Tournament Poker Edge. You are going to find both theory videos and full hand history reviews. So you'll find people talking about big, you know, theoretical strategy concepts, and also a variety of players with a variety of styles at a variety of stakes, walking hand for hand through poker tournaments that they've played. These are mostly online tournaments, but the majority of what you learn is going to be applicable to live tournaments as well. And I've actually just published a series on there called LOL Liveaments that is about a live poker tournament. And I do try to talk specifically about how to apply some of these, or just some things that are different when you're playing a live poker tournament. So for a really thorough look at tournament poker strategy, tournamentpokeredge.com.
Hi, I'm Bernard Lee. In the world of poker, I wear a lot of different hats. Professional poker player, writer, radio host, media personality, and of course, member of Team Run Good. Whether I'm writing a poker column, hosting my own radio show, or duking it out for a bracelet at the World Series of Poker, I'm sporting Run Good gear. Right now, my favorite item is the Run Good Nike pullover, and I don't leave home without it. Head to rungoodgear.com, and don't forget to use the promo code POKERNEWS. That's right, Poker News podcast fans, you can get 10% off your entire purchase by simply typing into the promo code box POKERNEWS. It's that easy. So head on over to rungoodgear.com and don't forget the promo code POKERNEWS to save 10% off your next purchase. I'm Bernard Lee, and see you at the final table.
Our first hand is coming to us from our friend Gareth Chandler. And again, for those of you who might be new listening to the show, definitely encourage you to go back and listen to some of the Gareth Chandler episodes. G-A-R-E-T-H is his first name. C-H-A-N-T-L-E-R is his last name. Just Google that and Thinking Poker, and you're going to turn up a couple different episodes that Gareth's been on. He's a really interesting, entertaining guy and also has some great strategic insights. And here's, I think, a very interesting hand that he played. This is from a Spring Championship of Online Poker tournament on PokerStars. It was a $27 one rebuy, one add-on tournament. Gareth promptly took the rebuy, and I believe he said that his opponents in this hand did not, which tells you a little something about them. It suggests that they probably are not professionals or real serious, like most serious players playing this tournament, or I shouldn't say serious, but most professionals playing this tournament, or really studied people playing this tournament, are going to take that immediate rebuy because they expect to have a pretty big edge on those chips when they buy them. So when people don't immediately take that rebuy, you can probably assume that they're more amateurish players. Does that sound right to you, Nate?
I think that's right. I certainly think that's right.
So that's about the only read that that he's got on these players. This is from very early in the tournament. The blinds are at 20 and 40. Our hero has 11,000 chips, so almost 300 big blinds. It folds to him on the cutoff with queen-jack offsuit. He opens to 80, so a minimum raise. He's called on the button by a player with 8,000 chips, or about 200 big blinds, and also by the small blind, who has 4,700 chips, or about 120 big blinds. So what we've got so far is Gareth opening from the cutoff with queen-jack offsuit, the button and the cutoff call, and he's about 100 big blinds deep with one player, 200 big blinds deep with the button.
Yeah, button and the small blind call.
So we go to the flop. And the flop is Ace of diamonds, seven of diamonds, four of diamonds, and Gareth is holding the jack of diamonds, so he has the third nut flush draw on an ace, seven, four, all diamond flop. The small blind checks. Gareth bets 123 into a pot of 280. I think this is a pretty clear bet, and the more interesting question is about the sizing.
Yeah, I like the size, I think. There'll be people who argue that it's too small, that you want to give some of the worse one card flush draws more of a decision, and so you should bet a little bit more. Well, that's not right. Gareth has the jack of diamonds. So this is all the more reason to bet small, because you want to keep those, you know, fives with the five of diamonds in. Some people will say it's too small and that you want to have a larger bet size with your whole range, because other times you won't have the jack of diamonds and you will want those hands to fold. I think this small size is fine. Especially if you're capable of barreling future streets. Like keeping those hands is not such a bad thing if you're going to have a good balanced bluffing strategy later. And spoiler alert, Gareth is not afraid to fire off a little bit. So that's I actually like this. I think like betting 99 into 280, that'd be a little bit small. I think betting 200 would be too much. I could imagine some arguments for some different sizes in there, but I think, especially given Gareth's style, maybe some of these more inexperienced players are not going to use a slightly smaller bet size as a reason to call on a scary board. That might be a reason to make it cheaper with your whole range. I think I like the sizing. What do you think?
I definitely like the sizing with his exact hand for a lot of the reasons that you gave. And I would also say, really, that you, as Gareth, you want to get called by hands like black eights, if somebody has 8-8 without a diamond. Even though you have only about 50% equity against that hand, you might think you want that hand to fold. That's a hand that's almost certainly going to fold the multiple barrels. And looking at this flop, it would certainly be my intention to bet multiple times. I think you're just going to get, I think the flop bet's going to get called by a lot of one pair hands, a lot of weak draws, and you have a hand that has really good equity against both of those. That even has decent equity against an ace, has decent equity against low made flushes. So you have like every incentive in the world to be barreling here. And this is something you should think about before you make your first bet. You know, am I going to be betting future streets? So, you know, there are good reasons why you want to induce a lot of loose calls on the flop, even though technically you're bluffing, because realistically, any hand that can't call multiple barrels is a hand that you're value betting against on the flop, because that's money, or, you know, short of them hitting a miracle on the turn, that's money that you're going to pick up with your turn or river barrel, even when your hand doesn't get there. So I think that in a circumstance where you have either a strong hand or a hand that you plan on barreling multiple times, then you want to get called by some weaker hands on this board, and I think that the small sizing is good. It would be less good with hands that Gareth is planning on betting once and then giving up, which, again, exploitively, he might not have very many hands like that on this board. He may be looking at this as just a good board to barrel in general, and not really plan on having a check give up range on the turn. And that would be, I think, an exploitive decision to make based on how he thinks these players will play. I think that you would probably want to bet a little bigger than this if you were playing against some really good players who you thought were not going to be exploitable in such obvious ways. Just based on the stack depth, I would think that you would want to be trying to access stacks a little bit more with somewhat larger bets.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. So the turn, are we ready for the turn?
Let's complete the flop action first.
Oh, yes.
He gets called in both spots, which is what we wanted, really. So the button and the small blind both call Hero's bet of 123.
I'm sorry, just a small question. Would you rather get called in both spots here or get called just by the small blind?
So I would definitely rather both spots than just the button. I think that once the small blind overcalls, it's extremely unlikely he has a hand that's going to call multiple barrels. I think he's check-raising most of his strongest hands. Like, he might slow play them heads up. When you bet, the button calls, and then the action's on small blind, I think he's almost always check-raising his strongest hands. So I think that one, the last 123 to go in there from the small blind is almost free money.
I like that.
It's a little more complicated if we make the small blind the only caller and pull button out of the equation. because like there is a greater chance that the button is slow playing something because he still has the small blind live decked behind him, and he's going to have position later in the pot, which are both incentives for him to slow play a bit. I think on balance, it's still better to get called by both, though. But I would definitely like a call just by the small blind better than just by the button.
I agree. I like everything you just said. That said, what can he really be slow playing? Like a set, a lot of people, especially at the $27 level, are not going to want to not raise with on the flop. They would hate to lose to 6-4 with the six of diamonds or however unlikely that might be. So I'm not sure you're going to see those slow playing a lot. Ace king with the king of diamonds that will often re-raise before the flop. You hold the jack of diamonds. I suppose there's ace queen with the queen of diamonds, ace 10 with, and beyond that, that pretty much exhausts the hands that you don't have good equity against. I suppose there's like ace 7, but again, those might raise the flop.
What about flop flushes?
Oh, right. So there are those, but I think given that you hold the jack, given that he called pre-flop, I think, given the card removal of the ace and the jack, I think there might be somewhat fewer slow playing hands than we might otherwise worry about. Yeah, and indeed, the jack will be a redraw against some of those. So I guess that's why I'm a bit less worried about those.
Okay, so we go to the turn with 649 chips in the pot, and the turn is the King of Hearts. I would think of that as, it's a relatively blank card, but given the hero's plan of barreling, it's a pretty good card, both because it gives hero a gut shot, and because it's going to be, to some extent, a scare card for someone holding. I mean, I think Pocket Eights is probably folding a lot to barrels anyway, but the King is a little bit of extra incentive for them to do that. It opens up, like, it makes hands like Ace King and Pocket Kings, the hero may have been on the flop. It makes them, it just kind of broadens the value range the hero could be barreling again on the turn, I think.
Yeah.
So, and I don't think it's very likely to improve opponents' hands. The only hand that is really improved would be like King Diamonds X. If someone had like King Queen with the King of Diamonds, now they've picked up a pair. That hand was probably not folding the turn anyway, so I don't think that's that big of a deal.
Seems right.
Like the King of Diamonds is probably not folding to any turn bet, regardless of whether it made a pair.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, but. Okay, it's close to true, I think. So,
The small blind checks. There's 649 in the pot. It sounds like you and I are in agreement that hero should be barreling here. What do you think in terms of sizing?
Yes, good barrel spot, good barrel card. So definitely I would bet. I would say not a micro barrel. I think you should really try to fold out pairs. Like you should target hands that are maybe even as good as top pair. You should try to make people think. A first instinct would be something like 2/3 of the pot. And it looks like Gareth did just about that. What do you think?
Yeah, I would lean between 2/3 and full pot. I think that when you say targeting top pair, there is a chance that an ace is going to fold on the turn. I think it's somewhat unlikely, but I do think it's plausible that with a third barrel, I think it's a lot more plausible to get people off of hands as strong as an ace. But to do that, and I mean, in order to make players in a $27 tournament fold top pair, even on a kind of scary board, my belief is that you kind of have to hit him over the head with the idea that, like, I have a strong hand. So as you get more and more confident that your opponent's ranges are capped, the safer you can be in just kind of blowing up the pot with your bet size, and knowing that even if they call a big bet on the turn, that if you're still anticipating a profitable river barrel, which I think we can on almost any river, then that is still money in the bank when you're called on the turn, and to some extent inflating the pot on the turn just enables you to make bigger river bets.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, there are a lot of situations where the story you want to tell is, I have some bluffs and some pretty good hands, so fold your worst hands that you got to this place with. And that's all well and good. That's exactly the right thing to do sometimes. This time, it's just very easy and a very good idea, I think, to tell the story, I have a value hand and I'm value betting you. So think about folding even a king, maybe even an ace. I think that's what you want to be doing.
So, as you said, Gareth bets 456, which is, if anything, I would say on the low end of the range that he should be betting, but definitely within that range. I think it's a fine bet. The button and the small blind both call again.
Interesting.
We go to the river now with 2017 in the pot. The small blind, I think, has about 4,000 remaining in his stack, a little less. The button has like 7,000 still in his stack, and Hero has them both covered by a fair bit. And the river is the Queen of Hearts. So the final board is Ace of Diamonds, Seven of Diamonds, Four of Diamonds, King of Hearts, Queen of Hearts. And our hero is holding Queen Jack with the Jack of Diamonds. So he's river to pair. How much showdown value do you think that actually gives him, considering the hands that his opponents are likely to hold right now?
Very little. I would say he wins at showdown 4% of the time.
I was going to say 10, but that wasn't really based on anything. I was probably just rounding to a convenient number. So, yeah, I mean, with only one player in the pot, you have a... Even then, though, I mean, because of the board, the way the board is rolled out, like, the most likely non-pair hands to have called on the flop were contained either the King of Diamonds or the Queen of Diamonds. And now that a King and a Queen have both come, I mean, I guess you do have the Nut Queen, so, like, there's some chance you're up against Queen 10 with the Queen of Diamonds. But, yeah, it's pretty hard to imagine hands worse than a pair of queens being out there. So, like, the only thing you could kind of hope to beat at showdown would be a queen with a bad kicker.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, like, 8-7 with the 8 of diamonds and hands like that.
Yeah. You're right, they're out there. But
nines with the 9 of diamonds, these hands.
We have pretty minimal showdown value. We can certainly agree on that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think another good preliminary question is let's put our opponents on some hands. I think the button is very unlikely to be slow playing now after he just called the turn again in a three-way pot. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I think even when you see slow playing on the flop, as I mentioned, it's more common in heads-up pots. So given the small blind is overcalled on the flop, the big blind, the button, if he doesn't currently have the nuts, is probably going to be pretty concerned that the small blind is drawing and will want to raise the turn. Plus, you know, at this point, Hero's shown pretty significant interest in the pot. So the button may think he's basically got Hero on the hook and now he can reel him in.
I agree that he's unlikely to, the button's unlikely to have slow played twice. I think his likeliest hands are middling aces without a flush draw and other pairs, including possibly aces with a flush draw. I think that a lot of those hands will fold to a bet. So I think that's the likeliest stuff for button to have. Pretty good made hands, pretty good busted flush draws, or maybe some mix of both. And indeed, I think the small blinds range is a bit similar. I would say the biggest differences between buttons and small blinds range have to do with how their preflop ranges will have Bayesian effects.
Can you say a bit more about what you mean by Bayesian effects?
Yeah, I think that the button is likely to have a few more hands. I think if the small blind is playing well, he's not going to be cold calling with too many hands, like, I don't know, 9-8 offsuit or something like that, whereas the button might have taken a shot with some hands like that. So if we're thinking about how likely the small blind is to have a hand like ace-jack offsuit, I think that might be a little bit, I think the small blind's range might be weighted a little more toward hands like that than the button, both because the button should have other hands like maybe ace three suited or a hand like that, or because the button might have re-raised ace jack before the floppy. So I think the small blind can be put a bit more squarely on, is a bit more likely to have middling aces and hands like that, whereas the button can have more different things.
Yeah, that all sounds right to me. And I might just say now, because I don't know if we've really, I mean, we talked a bit about that we think this is a really good barreling spot. And like the turn, I think also the river helps that out a lot. And the main reason for this, or I guess that there are two main reasons for this. One has to do with the fact that the hero was the preflop aggressor, and this is a board that I think maybe not the absolute strongest hands, but most of the stronger hands on this board are hands that are much more likely to be in the range of a preflop aggressor than a preflop caller. So like all of the sets, queens maybe a little bit less likely that hero would barrel flop and turn to, in order to river a set of queens, but like aces and kings are both hands that hero is more likely to have than the other players, given that they didn't three bet. Ace king and ace queen are both very, you know, very plausible hands that hero could have that the other players might have three bet pre-flop. Not that I'd be shocked to see either of these players call ace king or ace queen, but I think you can discount those because they didn't three bet pre-flop. And so that's the first factor, is that a lot of the nutted, although not nut, hands, you know, a lot of the, like, top 10-15% hands on this board are far more likely to be in hero's range than his opponent's, and that's one strong argument for barreling. The other one is that the jack of diamonds is a pretty significant blocker, especially when the ace of diamonds is on the board. So you're not all suited hands are created equal. A lot of players will play a lot of ace x suited and not a lot of other, you know, suited combinations. So they'll play ace deuce suited, but they won't play any other deuce x suited. So they're going to have, like, anytime the ace of diamonds is on the board, your opponents are a lot less likely to have two diamonds in their hand. That's even so, I mean, that makes the jack of diamonds more significant, because a couple of the most likely hands that the most likely two diamond hands that don't include the ace of diamonds are, you know, king jack of diamonds, queen jack of diamonds, jack 10, jack 9, maybe even jack 8. So hero blocks all of those combinations. And then, you know, you could still run into king queen of diamonds, king 10, queen 10, queen 9. The 7 and the 4 even are kind of significant in that, you know, they block 8-7, 7-6, 5-4, 4-3. All of those are blocked by the cards on the board. So there's a lot of people, even loose players, aren't calling preflop with like 9-3 of diamonds. So realistically, there aren't that many flushes that are possible for the opponents, which reduces the likelihood of hero running into one of those really top-notch hands that are not really any more likely for him than for his opponents. So I think all of that adds up to making this a really good barreling spot.
And also because that makes it a really good value betting spot, too.
So yes. Yeah, I mean, if you did play this way with ace-queen, I think you can pretty safely bet it for value on the river.
Yeah, absolutely. Possibly even ace-jack.
Yeah. Although, I mean, you have to be, because, like, we're talking about maybe folding, getting our opponents to fold hands as strong as ace-jack. So I think that I wouldn't try to value bet ace jack or ace queen for the sizing that Gareth uses on the river.
That's right.
And let's talk about this, because this is probably the part of the hand that I disagree with most. Now there's 2017 in the pot, and as I said, like, the small blind has about 4,000 remaining in his stack. The button has 7,000 or so remaining in his stack. Hero overbets the pot significantly. Hero bets 45-67, which would be enough to put small blind all in to take more than half a button stack, but is more than twice the size of the pot. Go ahead.
So the first thing I want to say is that I love the creativity, and I love considering overbetting and underbetting. It's something that that so few people do. If you listen to our theory episodes, if you listen to our interviews with the Poker Snowy people, with the Alberta people, and with really good players, overbetting is something, you know, it's still an inefficiency in how people play. And it's a sign of creativity. It's a sign probably that you're approaching optimal play more than other people are. And I love that Gareth is thinking this way. And in particular, when your range is uncapped and the other guy's range is capped, that's a great time to bring on the heat. From a theory point of view, if you read Mathematics of Poker, when your range is so good that you can just sort of muscle the pot away from other people, that's often that's accomplished with big bets in toy games. And so. I like that Gareth is thinking this way. That said, I'm not sure that 4,500 accomplishes much that 2,500 or even 1,500 wouldn't. I'm not, you know, against this kind of player, I'm not sure ace nine is calling, you know, 1,700 or something like that.
Right. Yeah, and this is an instance where opponents' ranges are not exactly capped. Like, the strongest hands are not impossible for them. I mean, people do slow play aces sometimes. People do slow play king, queen of diamonds all the way to the river sometimes. So, you know, we're not thinking that it's impossible or even super unlikely for them to have those hands. I mean, I think that something like 5-10% of the time that someone has dealt aces or king, queen of diamonds, he will play it this way. 10's a high number, but 3-5% of the time. And that gets to be significant when you start betting such a large amount relative to the pot, especially when one of the reasons why this has been such a good barreling spot is that you can that you have a predominance of hands like ace queen and ace king, because when you bet an amount like 4500 on the river, that really heavily polarizes your range, where like I don't think you could profitably do this, as I said, with ace queen. I don't even think you could profitably do this with ace king. I think that like a set of kings is maybe the worst hand where I think I feel like I could consider doing this and getting called by enough second best hands to make it worthwhile. So overbetting by such a large amount kind of subtracts one of the range advantages that you have by taking these hands like ace king and ace queen functionally out of your river range. Whereas if you do bet, I think, like you said, Nate, between 1500 and 2500, maybe 1700 to 2500, I think that enables you to keep an ace king and ace queen in your betting range. And you risk less, obviously, with your bluffs, and I think that you also tell a more plausible story.
I agree. I think overbets this big are maybe best used against this kind of competition. Yes. When you're really trying to get them to fold a lot, like if you wanted them to fold maybe a small flush or something like that, then you might consider betting this big. And I think a better value target here is something like all one pair and maybe even some of the worst two pairs. But I think trying to fold out any hand one pair or worse is not a bad thing to target here. And I think you do that pretty well with something like full pot.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what I want to say. Because I mean the kind of the danger of doing this is A, running into like a slow played hand that's just not folding, and B, running into someone who's just really suspicious or really stationy. Like this is very early in a $27 tournament, so you know it's not beyond the pale that someone might just call with ace jack.
Sure.
So I mean that's why I think it is relevant to be able to keep hands like ace king or ace queen in your range. Not that that player is necessarily doing that much hand reading, but also to kind of limit your exposure when you are bluffing.
I agree.
But I agree with everything that you said about the creativity. I think it's a good spot to be thinking about betting big. I think even potting it or slightly overbetting it here is more than even like a lot of very good tournament players would think to do. It's just like when you get into playing mechanically, you don't think about these things. I think it's a good spot. He's on the right track in terms of betting big. I just think he went a little too big for this exact situation.
I agree.
It did work. Button and small blind both folded, but you know that's really not proof of the sizing being good, because I mean I would expect that they would fold very often to this bet. It's just a question of, are you risking about 2,000 chips more than you need to on the rare occasion that you get called?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they folded A7 and they wouldn't have. You know,
I highly doubt that we'll ever find out.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're Gareth and you think that we're wrong, write back and tell us why. If you're not Gareth and you're interested in this hand or any other hand or anything else about poker, or even, heck, some things not about poker, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. We would love to hear from you. We love listener mail, and it's a great part of the show.
Shark Optics, the official poker eyewear of the World Series of Poker.
Hi, I'm Greg Fosselman Raymer, and at the poker table, I wear Blue Shark Optics.
This is Jonathan Little. At the poker table, I wear Blue Shark Optics.
Hi, I'm Hoyt Corkins. When at the poker table, I wear Blue Shark Optics.
This is Chris Moneymaker. When I'm at the poker tables, I wear Blue Shark Optics.
You don't know me yet, but at the poker tables, I wear Blue Shark Optics.
Blue Shark Optics, because the hunt demands vision.
Retreat on the double.
Before we get to our second hand, I want to remind everyone that this is the last episode of the Thinking Poker podcast that is going to show up on the Thinking Poker feed. So here's how that's going to affect you. If you are someone who listens to the show just by going to thinkingpoker.net and finding the embedded player there and just clicking play and streaming it. Basically, you're not downloading it. You don't have a program that's downloading it for you. You're just streaming it week by week. You're not going to have to do very much more. I'm going to continue on Mondays to, or you know, whatever day the podcast happens to come out, but we aim for Mondays. I'm going to continue to post an announcement on the blog saying the new podcast is out. There'll be a link, so there'll just be one extra step, which is that instead of just clicking play from the blog, you'll click a link to a page, and then you'll click play on that page. So pretty easy for you. If you are someone who is subscribed to the podcast, so in iTunes or some sort of feed reader where just it's automatically downloaded for you whenever your computer connects to that service, then you're going to have to change, you're going to have to subscribe to the new feed. It's not going to be showing up here anymore. So again, there's links on the, there will be links on the blog to help you find this, or you can go to pokernews.com/podcast, and there are links on there that will enable you to subscribe via iTunes, or if you just want the URL for the feed, to subscribe in a different podcasting app of some sort that's set up. Worst case scenario, if you have trouble finding us, just leave a comment on the blog or email us podcast@thinkingpoker.net, and as long as it doesn't get out of hand, we can, on a case-by-case basis, provide some individualized help. It's very important to us that we don't lose you, and we appreciate you are taking the extra effort to find us over at Poker News, and hopefully this will be a pretty smooth transition for everyone.
Absolutely, absolutely. So our second hand comes from the Poker Stars Sunday Million from, I don't know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago, something like that. It's either 7 or 8 handed, and there are some, you know, many medium stacks and a couple short stacks at the table, and it folds to the blinds. The small blind has roughly 9 million to start the hand, and the big blind is 400,000, so they're at 200,000, 400,000 with an ante. The big blind has something like 13.5 million. So just to recap, 200,000, 400,000 with an ante, small blind has about 9 million, big blind has about 13.5 million. And they're at the final table, the Sunday Million. The small blind opens for a min raise with ace-six suited. The big blind 3-bets to 1.775 million or so with ace-king offsuit. And the small blind calls. So it goes min raise, small 3-bet, and call. Now, this is already interesting that we have a 3-bet pot that's not all in, that leaves plenty of money behind when both people are starting off, when the effective stack is about 23 big blinds. I don't think that's bad. I indeed would like to have a 3-bet range that's not all in here, but 23 big blinds is getting close to where that's not really tenable. As soon as you make it even like 17 or 18 big blinds, then I think that I would not have a 3-betting range that is not all in. I would have folding, calling, and jamming ranges if I were the big blind. So one first very fundamental thing is to talk about the small blind's opening raise size. So ace-six suited, I think we can all agree that's a hand that really needs to be played. There are ICM considerations here, and in fact, those are very important to this hand. I think they affect a lot about how the hand plays out, especially at a tournament like the Sunday Million, where a lot of people at the final table are playing for, if not life-changing to them, certainly bankroll-changing to them money. This is a case where tournament considerations will make big differences, but even so, ace-six suited is just too good a hand with a lot of money in the pot and a random hand at the big blind. It really has to be raised or possibly limp jammed, or you need to play it and assume that it's good until you have a reason to think it's not. Usually I would not min raise from the small blind, but given some of these tournament considerations, sometimes smaller than usual bet sizes can make sense. There are a lot of variables that affect this. I would probably default here to something like 900 or 920 or 925,000, but I can see the reasoning for a min raise. What do you think?
You know, so much depends on, like, it's such a common thing in tournaments to use these really, really small sizings, especially when you get into, like, the 3 and 4 bets, because you're talking about the big blind making such a small 3-bet, And, you know, all of this stuff depends on your opponent not taking advantage of the pot odds that you're giving them to call with as wide of a range as they theoretically should.
Right.
And that happens, it works out that way a lot when you're dealing with what I would call the typical tournament player. I know there are a lot of people who have rules for themselves that they, like, just don't ever flat three bets, or they don't ever flat four bets or something like that. And, I mean, if you're playing against someone who's just going to ignore the fact that he's getting 4-1 and insists that he has to either shove or fold, then a really tiny 3 or 4 bet is a great way to leverage his stack, because you can risk something like 3 big blinds and put your opponent to, maybe a little more than that, but, like, you can risk something like 4 or 5 big blinds and put your opponent to a 20-25 big blind decision, which if your opponent artificially restricts himself to shoving or folding is a great thing to be able to do. So, you know, we don't know the history on this hand. This is just from a Sunday Million replay that you were watching. So it's possible that the big blind senses this about the small blind, thinks that the small blind is going to be extremely reluctant to call a raise, even getting extraordinarily good odds. I mean, I think that with ace-king offsuit, clearly you have a hand that's extremely strong, that you are downright happy to get all in blind versus blind. You would like to induce a shove with it. At the same time, I don't think you really do want to induce a call when you have ace-king offsuit. There's so much money in the pot already. I mean, ace-six suited exactly is a bit of an exception because you're such a huge favorite against that hand. But if the small blind is opening something like queen-ten suited, getting a call from that hand instead of forcing that hand to fold pre-flop is... I don't think the word disaster would be out of place.
Yeah, it's very poor. You don't want that to happen. You want to win the pot, especially at a final table. I think this is something that's underrated even in cash games. Like when somebody raises and you 3-bet ace-king and that person folds, I think people don't realize how, at least not bad. I mean, often you'll want a call and you'll invite a call, but picking up what's in the middle is, I think, better pre-flop than a lot of people realize sometimes. So I would err a little bit bigger, both as the opening raiser and as the 3-better here.
And then the thing is, like, if you go much bigger than that with your 3-bet, I don't think you can really afford to fold very many hands to a small blind shove. One of the reasons it might be a little safer here is that the small blind ought to be pretty reluctant to shove. One thing we haven't mentioned is there's a player at this table who has only about 4.5 big blinds.
Yeah.
So the ICM pressure on the small blind is really significant not to go broke here, because he can really just sit around and in all likelihood move up at least one pay jump. So there is a lot of pressure on the small blind. And if you think that you can get away with... I would think that your 3-bet folding range would want to be like ace-8 offsuit or somewhere in that neighborhood, like a hand that's probably good, that has a really significant blocker to hands that the small blind would be willing to shove. And if you think the small blind is shoving only a very tight range, a hand that performs pretty badly against that very tight range. That's like about the only hand that I could see 3-betting and folding once you're getting something like 2-1, which is if you go much over the size that the big blind here chose to 3-bet, that's about the odds that you're going to be getting.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I remember in tempo when I was just watching the replay, I thought that 1.9 would be a good 3-bet size. And again, if you make the effective stack even a little bit shorter, I would just jam, but. I do think that the hands that you discuss are the ones that you want to be 3-betting and folding if there are any such hands.
There's kind of like these two funny principles that work against each other in these situations where ICM is such a big factor, and it kind of turns into a game of chicken, like where he's trying to raise the other one back and neither player is inclined to believe the other one. Because on the one hand, you'd like to risk as little as possible to make each of your raises, because you're kind of just daring your opponent, like he either has it or he doesn't. And if you're expecting not to get a lot of calls, especially where it's like either your opponent has a good enough hand to raise or he's going to have to fold, then you want to use a very small sizing for that. And just generally, I mean, the leverage principle is very strong here, where you can force your opponent or threaten a lot of your opponent's stack with a very small bet or raise. That happens when you're shallow, and it happens even more so in a tournament, and even more so at a final table, where the ability to use leverage is really heightened. So that argues for using very small bets. On the other hand, the way to win a game of chicken, and I forget where I first heard this, but I like it a lot, is to let your opponent see you throw the steering wheel out the window. If you're playing the game of chicken in a car, basically, and that's going all in is the equivalent of that in a tournament where if neither player has anything and each person thinks the other one doesn't have anything, the player who wins is the first one who goes all in. Because you can always raise again with nothing. The thing you can't do is call with nothing. So giving your opponent the opportunity to jam on you can be problematic. I mean, not when you have ace-king, but it's hard to do that as a bluff because your opponent doesn't... Like, there's no reason your opponent has to believe you. This is blind versus blind in a situation where the big blind has a ton of incentive to 3-bet light and put a lot of pressure on the small blind. So, like, there are some small blinds who might jam a really wide range over a small 3-bet from the big blind thinking that he's going to do that with like almost any two cards, at which point you really don't want to be folding when you're getting close to 2-1, even if you have a kind of bad hand, which makes it hard for you to have a small 3-betting range, which means when you do have a small 3-betting range, maybe you do have a really strong hand, which means the small blind shouldn't shove a really wide range, which means you don't need a really good hand. I mean, you get into this like circular logic.
Yeah, and when you get cycles like that, then what that means is that you need to pull out a pen and paper and just do some math and figure out some game theory, which I haven't done for this spot, but you should. Right. So we go to the flop and there's something like 4 million in the pot, a little bit more maybe, and 7.5 behind roughly. Flop comes jack of diamonds, 10 of diamonds, deuce of spades. So in terms of hitting the flop, it's a bad flop for ace six suited. situation's more complicated for ace king offsuit. I believe there were no diamonds. I have not preserved the suits in the hand history. It matters a little bit. So sorry. And the small blind checks. The big blind, who is also the three better, decides to make a small bet on the flop. Something in the neighborhood of like 1.65 million. Should I reveal the next action, or do we want to talk about this?
I guess we can mention this briefly. So I mean, this is the ace king betting on the jack 10 deuce flop and betting very small. And this strikes me as a very clear instance to bet small. Like the stack to pot ratio, the effective stack to pot ratio is something like 1.5 to 1. So, and this is another instance where a small bet can very effectively leverage the entire stack of the small blind. If anything, I think you could maybe get away with betting even less than the big blind here did. It seems like he's betting more than a third of the pot, and that honestly seems like maybe even more, like just enough that you're leaving behind one pot-sized bet. I can't really think of any hand where, because I mean, I think the small blind is going to either shove or fold with pretty much, like, I really can't think of a hand that the small blind should just call even a very small bet with. I think this is a spot where the small blind ought to shove or fold, because the big blind, like, isn't, I mean, even if he has a strong three-betting range pre-flop, he's still going to have ace-king, which means if you're the small blind and you flopped two diamonds, you flopped 8-9, you flopped king-queen, some of these hands where it might seem like pot odds matter, shoving and having some fold equity is probably going to be better than just calling and trying to see one more card. If you flopped a jack or a 10, I think you're just going to be shoving. I can't really see doing anything else. So I really don't see an instance here where, despite what I was saying about the preflop spots, where I think it's a mistake or it's a potentially exploitable thing to give your opponent really good odds to call you, even when you have a strong hand. This is an instance where I think that the small blind pretty much has to raise or fold.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like everything you said. And, you know, this is a good case where a sort of simple rule has an exception. And the simple rule is the more draw heavy the board is, the more you should bet, the more continuation bet ought to be. And there are well-known reasons for this. There are more draws to price out, and indeed there are more draws that you need to put more pressure on, let's say, or maybe you will on the turn. Now, that rule has many exceptions, and this is one of them. You know, jack 10 deuce with two diamonds, that's about as draw heavy as boards get. And this is a case where betting very small is a good idea. Of course, this is a very unusual situation, but there are other counterexamples also. There are other exceptions too. And I think we should register that. That was one reason that you know, I was a little bit surprised to see Andrea Beth Small, and it took me a second to realize why such a small bet might be useful. And it's interesting now to hear that indeed even a smaller bet than was actually used could have been effective. And I now sort of agree with that. I think it's the right thing. So George, possibly will this may call into question some things that Andrew just said, but the small blind actually min raised almost immediately. So one effect of the very small bet was that it allowed room for a bluff raise that was not all in, that would leave that if it failed would still leave him with say 10 big blinds or even like 12 or 13 big blinds. So it went check bet. Very fast min check raise. Then Andrea folded, actually. He folded the ace-king, which was a surprise to me. So
Once again, gets to my point about players who don't take advantage of hot odds that are offered to them.
No kidding. I mean, it was like tank and then fold. I mean, it was really something. But on the other hand, this is the small blind accepting the pot odds in a certain respect, you know, leaving, you know, accepting the better price on a min raise.
Right.
So this was... this was remarkable. I think you should not be betting ace king with the intent of folding. I think that's not the right thing to do, just for the fundamental reasons. Like, even if he's value heavy when he raises you here, ace king, two over cards, and a gut shot plays fine, even against value heavy ranges when the stacks are this short and there's that much money in the pot. So I think, you know, I'm not somebody who will call off with a good draw for any price. Of course, no good player is like that. But at this depth, I think bet folding is a disaster.
Yeah. And part of the reason it's such a disaster, because in like ace king is not always that strong of a hand on the jack 10x flop.
Right.
It matters a lot here that ace jack is almost certainly shoving preflop.
Yes.
Queens plus, tens plus are like definitely shoving. I mean, anything other than shoving preflop in the small blind shoes with tens or better is a disaster.
Yes.
Ace jack, there's a little bit more room to argue, but I still think it's a pretty clear shove preflop. I could maybe even see, you know, some tens doing this for value, or you know, deciding that like check min raise, call it off is going to be slightly better than just check shoving. So I mean, I think that a hand like king 10 is possible, maybe even king jack is possible. So I'm not going to guarantee 100% that your ace or king are live, but they're really likely to be live. I mean, this is a case where even if the small blind does have a hand that he's like check raising that's better than ace king that he's intending to call it off with, you're going to have pretty good equity. Like, usually you're going to have 10 outs. Sometimes you'll have 9 outs because you're up against queen jack or queen 10. Sometimes you'll only have 7 outs because you're up against king jack. But I don't think you can be in that bad of a shape with your ace king. And because of, I mean, there are only so many hands that the small blind can be checking to induce with, especially once you pull out tens plus an ace jack and probably even ace 10 from his range. There just aren't that many ways that he can have a hand strong enough to call a shove with. So I mean, I do think you have, like, as we see here, he had an air ball. So, and I do think you have some fold equity, like not against better hands, but there's a ton of money in the pot. And if you can win that without a contest, when all you have is ace high, that's a pretty great outcome as well. So I really can't see doing anything. I mean, I think that folding is worse than calling, but I think I would just shove from the big blind's perspective and be pretty happy that the small blind gave me an opportunity to make him blink less.
I absolutely agree with that. Everything you said, I think a lot of our listeners would do well to hit the rewind 30 seconds button on their listeners of choice if they have it and listen to that again. I absolutely agree with it. One thing that I would add is that the small preflop 3-bet size matters here. The wider you make the small blinds range, you know, it does put some more tens into the small blinds range, which is, you know, it makes some more value hands possible. But a lot of those are hands that your ace and your king are live against, and also it puts a lot more gut shots, random diamonds, etc., in the small blinds range.
Well, I would actually say I don't think we're going to see diamonds from the small blind here. I mean, I think check shoving diamonds is so much better than like check min raising, calling it off with diamonds.
Sure, I'm speaking about check raising generally. I do think you want fold equity so much that I don't think there are a lot of players who are going to be trying so hard to be balanced here that they're going to check min raise their whole range if they think they should have a check min raising range. I agree with that. That said, at this point, we're talking about exploitive play, which is worth thinking about here. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I mean, certainly, we've got to be thinking about that. But if we're just thinking about what's the small blind's check raising range, then I do think it's worth thinking about the way in which the small three bet size before the flop affects the range you get to the flop with, and then what might be in a raising range. And then we should go back and say, okay, it was a small raise instead of a big one, so we can probably take some of these drawing hands, like pure draws, out. And I think you're right about that. But yeah, especially if you're going. So in my point here, more important even than figuring out the details of the small blind's range is saying that, like, harmonizing your play across streets is really important. Bet folding ace king on the flop is not only a disaster, it's even worse when you're making really small three bets on a preflop. It, you know, leaving more hands in to bluff you out is just really bad. Making a bad play worse, it's not good. Anything else to say about this?
I don't think so. I mean, the bottom line is, don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to have to fold away a lot of equity getting good pot odds.
I agree. And, you know, gutsy play sometimes pays off. Here it did for the small blind.
I mean, I definitely respect the creativity of the small blind's min check raise. Like, because, I mean, I talked a lot about, and I mean, I did realize what happened in the hand, like, as I was talking through why the big blind can get away with such a small C bet. Yeah. It did kind of occur to me. I was like, oh, wait, he actually kind of got owned for doing that. I mean, I think it was his own mistake to end up folding to the raise, but it does open a new strategic option for the small blind. I think it's really good that, you know, clearly the small blind here, and it's not a coincidence that you see this kind of play at the final table of the Sunday Million. It's not easy to make the final table of that tournament. Not to say that weak players never do it, because, you know, people can get lucky, but I mean, I think this is the kind of really creative, skillful play that helps you to make runs like this, where he saw an opportunity and to take a big pot with minimal risk, meaning he didn't have to risk a lot of money compared to what was in the pot to have a shot at taking it down, and he went for it, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that had to be a read-based play. I mean, I can't be sure, of course, but precisely because a three-betting range is going to have enough to continue with on this flop so often, like, you have to think he didn't just say, like, oh, A6 is a great hand to have in my min-check and raising range against a three-better on a jack-10 deuce, two-diamonds board. I mean, that just seems like just running into a brick wall. I mean, it just seems like a terrible play to me, which makes me think that this was a read-based play and a really good one, but that's just speculation, of course.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Last thing, we want to welcome back to the show the music, which is from a band called Palmyra. Longtime listeners of our show will probably recognize and be happy to hear again the intro music and the outro music that you're about to hear. For a couple of weeks when we first came over here to Poker News, we needed to work out with them how we were going to handle using their music in a more commercial way than we'd used before. And of course, on last week's episode, since we had a musician on the show, it just made sense to use some music from Thesaurus. But we are very happy to have Palmyra back on the show. And we definitely encourage you all to, if you enjoy that music, check out palmyra.bandcamp.com. That's palmyra.bandcamp.com, and you can purchase at a very reasonable price the music that you've heard on the show and some other songs by that group as well. And I would say, I mean, Palmyra, we've probably gotten, not probably, like, we've definitely gotten more emails about Palmyra than about anyone else we've had on the show. I mean, granted, they're on every episode, but yeah. People have really enjoyed that music, so we're happy that we were able to keep them with us now that we're over here with Poker News.
Yeah. A lot of tweets, a lot of emails. I mean, long time, like, and here people would probably have to be listening for at least a year. Back when we had Mono Gold as the standard music, we got a fair amount of requests from them. But I think Palmyra, both in absolute and sort of per week terms, has to be our podcast leader in listener requests.
Excellent.
Have a good week, everybody.